History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And really, they don't have to go untold. If we'll just take the initiative to ask a few questions of some of our more experienced neighbors, and more importantly, to patiently listen to what they have to say, it's amazing how much we can learn. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price it's been paid for our freedom. And not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. There's a lot going on this time of year. Valentine's Day, it's also Black History Month, but the middle of February each year also brings the Day of Remembrance, something that is very important to Americans of Japanese ancestry, and as I hope we all understand by the time this hour is over, really should be important to the rest of us as well. February 19th marks the 79th anniversary of Executive Order 9066, which led to the incarceration of 120,000 people forced out of their West Coast homes and locked up behind barbed wire simply because of their heritage. At the time, even those who wanted to enlist in our armed forces were denied that opportunity and declared enemy aliens. I don't know about you, but when I listen to veterans share their stories here on Hometown Heroes, I often try to imagine how I might handle some of the situations they were faced with. And while every story is unique, I have to say that some categories stand out. It's always sobering to hear from a veteran who's been severely wounded, or one that has become a prisoner of war and doesn't know when or if he'll ever taste freedom again. There's another group that always really gets to me. Anytime I have the privilege of visiting with a veteran who chose to risk his life for the very country that was holding his family captive, it really makes me wonder if I would have been able to make that same choice. You've heard dozens of Nisei veterans on this program over the years, but today we're going to hear about a new book that captures that chapter of our history from a few different lenses. The book is Tears of Honor, a novel of Japanese-American heroism in World War II. The author is James Ardize, formerly a prosecutor, judge, and presiding justice of the California 5th District Court of Appeals. That background in the legal realm gives him perspective on the infamous 1944 case Korematsu versus United States, in which the Supreme Court upheld Executive Order 9066 as constitutional. Since then, of course, that's been repudiated, but Ardize also captures how this time in history impacted people and families. And he introduces us to some heroes you may never have heard about. Again, the book is Tears of Honor. I have it linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. It's the culmination of years of painstaking research and interviews by James Ardize, who joins us now. Can you tell us why this project was so important to you and what it was that really compelled you to write Tears of Honor?
Well, it started out with me giving a speech about the Korematsu decision and the failure of the American judiciary when they were confronted with these detention orders. And as I began to explore that, I became more and more interested in the background and then the story, and then it expanded. Why did the government do this? The human interest aspect of the people that were relocated and detained, and why did they go as peacefully and as passively as they did? What was the motivation of the men that went and fought in Europe and left the camps, and my curiosity about why would somebody go and fight for their country the way that they did when the country had rejected their parents and left their parents in detention centers. And those were real detention centers, I mean, with armed guards and wire and guard towers with machine guns. So I just started reading more and more about it, and I thought, nobody really knows this story from all different perspectives, and how would you present that? That evolved into the idea of writing this book and telling aspects of this story that I thought were really important.
And that's what strikes me about what you've done here, is that there are books that capture a first-person account. maybe even multiple first-person accounts. And that's what we hear on this show, are first-person accounts, people who live some of this. But to bring all the different perspectives that you bring together in this expansive view of it, from what I've read over the years, I mean, this is unprecedented. I'm curious for you. I mean, both of your parents were in World War II. I'm sure you grew up with some kind of awareness of what had happened in the internment, and you read about Korematsu in law school. But I have the sense that in the last 5 years working on this book, that you've learned a lot yourself that you're now passing on to us.
Well, that's really true. You know, I have long had an interest in history, and I was aware of the 442nd. I really wasn't that much aware of the 100th because they generated out of Hawaii. I was aware of Manzanar. I wasn't aware of Jerome and Rohrer and Poston, the internment camps that existed. I was kind of aware of our Fresno fairgrounds being used, but I really didn't give it a lot of thought. I mean, like most kids growing up in the valley, I went to the fair, I saw the stables and the rest of that, but I didn't relate it to any of that. I didn't really know the story of how people in the Central Valley reacted to this, and I wanted to, as I read about it, I wanted to tell the story that people here recognize the distinctions between ethnic groups. Didn't really make any difference. I mean, the valley is a real stew, an ethnic stew. You have Italians and you have Armenians and you have Irish and you have Germans and Portuguese and Mexicans and everything else. They've always maintained a certain amount of ethnic distinction, although that's kind of dissipated over the years. But it back in these times, World War II, the separation among the ethnic groups was much more distinct. And yet at the same time, they all viewed themselves as Americans. And of course, obviously, there was prejudice. There were all kinds of things. But when push came to shove and we got down to this, the valley really reflected an attitude of, well, these are our neighbors. You know, they may not look the same. They may not talk exactly the same. These are our neighbors. And I was very impressed with the fact of how many people actually took their neighbors' farms and farmed for them. And when their neighbor returned, they gave the keys back and they gave the money back and everybody went on and nobody talked about that. Yeah, there were distinctions, but in the end they were all neighbors and that's how they behaved. And I thought, you know, that's an important point, that they viewed themselves maybe not so much even as Americans, but as neighbors. Many of them were personally opposed to what happened to the Japanese Americans, but they weren't vocal like they are now. You know, now everybody goes out and marches around, they have a placard, and people didn't do that. I couldn't even imagine if we singled out an ethnic group nowadays and said, I want you to report to the Fresno fairgrounds, that they would do it the way it was done here. So all of these things I thought were interesting stories that give us a perspective on our forebears. And then there's just such heroism and patriotism involved here. I mean, it's a real American story.
Well, and you said something there, you know, if something like this happened today, how would people react? And whether that be an ethnic group or an age group or an ideological group, if something like this was attempted again, how different would it be? And I get the sense that that's part of the motivation for writing this book, to hope that there's a way to ensure this never happens again. Kind of like the way we talk about the Holocaust, right? It's important to keep that history alive so it doesn't happen again. Was that part of your motivation for this? And are there some ways you tried to express that in there that you're really satisfied with how that came out to get that kind of point across?
The answer to that is yes. The one thing that I wanted to make clear in this book, and I really, it's very difficult to make it clear in a book of this nature because you're addressing so many different things, is how easily it happened. I mean, you look at the recourse that we would normally have, which is the court system, and you have all of this hysteria that exists in the United States at that time with the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, and the fact that you have an ethnic or racial group that is distinctive in appearance, and it doesn't take very much for things like this to happen. You have a failure of the government leadership, demagoguing an issue, for example, for political purposes, which whips people up in the frenzy. And then you have the judiciary, which is our point where they're supposed to resist this. They're not supposed to lead the mob. They're supposed to stand in front. Mm-hmm. And you have the failure of the American judiciary, which is what happened in Korematsu. And then you have the system begin to fall apart because it adapts to something that shouldn't have been adapted to. And so you see how easily civil rights and particular groups can just simply be segregated from society and their conduct justified. And it really doesn't make any difference whether it's based on ethnicity or race or ideology. When there's a real failure to recall or remember that this can happen to you, and you allow it to happen, you understand the consequences, how easily we can lose our liberty, how easily we can lose our freedom, how easily we forget that we have a common bond, which is the Constitution. It's not ethnic, it's the Constitution. We have kind of an American spirit, but the reality is it's the Constitution. And when we forget about that, we end up with things like what happened here. But I was amazed at how easily it happened. And yeah, I can see the same things occurring again whenever our institutions that are our stopgaps begin to fail.
And they didn't even have social media then. Can you imagine how much gas that would have put on the fire?
I always say all progress is not good.
On that note, and I want to talk to you about some of the other things you learned. I mean, you learned about a real hero that you tell the story of in this book, and I think that's going to be something a lot of people are thankful for when they read this book, is learning about a certain character in there. There are a lot of characters, real-life characters, that I've heard about from time to time, some who I've met in the past, but there's a real hero in here. You tell his story, and I want to get to that. But big picture-wise, again, I mean, you're a legal scholar. You've been in that world for so long. You knew about the Korematsu case. But in the research you've done, was there something that you've come across from the big picture and the timeline that became almost alarming to you or really eye-opening?
Well, yeah. I mean, when you go to law school, you read about famous American judges. You study their decisions. There are certain icons that exist. Earl Warren, William O. Douglas, Felix Frankfurter, Black, people like Justice Jackson and Murphy, and you read about their decisions. We think of them as liberals and conservatives. I realized in my research that Earl Warren, for example, who became governor of California and Chief Justice of the United States and is generally regarded as the principal architect of Brown versus Board of Education and major civil rights legislation. As I began to read about what he had done, I realized that Earl Warren was in many respects singularly responsible for the detention of the Japanese in World War II. I read the comments that he made, his public positions, and I realized that it was both racist and cynically opportunistic. I use the term racist in the sense that he said things that I don't think, we don't even have to look at it in terms of the time. I mean, they were racist at the time and they are racist now. And I was shocked at that. Mm-hmm. And I was shocked at the other names that I saw that were involved in this, William O. Douglas, people like that. The things that kind of American iconic figures did, which really to me were tarnish their legacy. I mean, it was hard for me to look at that and say, well, why didn't Earl Warren ever admit that what he did was just wrong? And the answer is he never did. And he didn't want to talk about it. He made one comment at one time, which implied that maybe he regretted some of it. But what he did was lead the way in probably one of the worst civil rights violations for American citizens that we have in our history. And that was shocking to me. I'm not naive, but that was shocking to me when I read it. And I did a lot of research about that. And there were people like, for example, J. Edgar Hoover, who has become somewhat of a reviled figure in American history. But J. Edgar Hoover, as the head of the FBI, was absolutely opposed to this and was very vocal with President Roosevelt that this was not the right thing to do. The Attorney General, a man by the name of Francis Biddle, was extremely opposed to this. So I was fascinated by how did we get ourselves into this mess? And did anybody start to think about it once it started to evolve? So those are things that I looked at. But again, I wanted to write a story about people. I mean, some people look at this and they say, well, it's a book about war. It isn't a book about war. War is the backdrop for a story about people. This is really about people. And a lot of the characters in this book, when you read about them, they aren't in the war. They are suffering the consequences of it, but they aren't in the war.
With respect to 9066 and the impact that it had and 120,000 Japanese Americans on the West Coast being forced off the land where many of them had been born, where they'd been making their living. I think a lot of people, especially those of us who weren't alive, we hear about it. And even some of the veterans I talk to, as they recall it, it has this tone of, well, it was an overreaction to what happened at Pearl Harbor. And this was purely a reactionary thing born out of the emotion of the moment. And it sounds like to me that in your research, you found out that wasn't necessarily the case, that there was some forethought given to this kind of exercise.
Yes, one of the things that I was able to do is research at Stanford the papers of a man by the name of Carl Benditson. And Carl Benditson was a Stanford law graduate. He was in the military, and he was really the individual who was the architect of this. You know, he was directed to do it, and he put it together logistically. But it was clear from his papers, and he kept everything, that this whole thing had been planned long in advance of Pearl Harbor. They were looking at not just the Japanese, but German nationals, Italian nationals, people that were living in this country that were not citizens, and they were contemplating how to deal with this whole thing, how to deal with Hawaii before Pearl Harbor happened. They had already plotted out all of the fairgrounds, for example, that could be used as relocation centers. So all of that had been done in advance. This was not something that somebody after Pearl Harbor said, oh, let's go use the fairgrounds. They had already decided all of this. They had a roadmap in place. And I found that out and was also able to do independent research for some other universities on the East Coast that were interested in answers to questions. And I found out how the military knew about all of that.
And as a follow-up question, and we know what happened to the Japanese Americans, and we've heard isolated instances of the way some Italian Americans and German Americans were treated, even to the degree of if they ended up in the military where they were sent. But have you been able to decipher that, why there wasn't a large-scale detention of those ethnicities the way there were with the Japanese Americans?
Yes, it became very clear in Benditson's papers and also my other research that they quickly realized at the highest levels of government that the Army had a lot of people of German descent, people of Italian descent. But the one comment that stood out to me more than anything else was the comment that they couldn't imprison the people that were Italian that were not yet citizens because Joe DiMaggio's father would have been imprisoned. And here is this, you know, this American baseball legend. And that really was one of the things that turned it. And it also isolated the Japanese Americans because they were easy to distinguish from Caucasians. There was a lot of prejudice, of course. Roosevelt, you know, he had his own views of Asians. You know, it was a different time. I mean, I'm not here to talk about, you know, being critical of the morality of people at that time, but they were able to single these people out. We had to have scapegoats. They, you know, they bombed Pearl Harbor. They're a scapegoat. That's kind of what allowed them to be separated and segregated.
It's time for our first break, but there's much more to come with author James Ardaiz. Learn more about his book, Tears of Honor, at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this.